Anthony Sayer.
This is what we do well, this sort of program, with Ilan Volkov as well. And it's a great program. It's a mixed bag, some very accessible music in it. And it's what we do well. Yes, it won't get a full house, and we wouldn't expect it, but we get a very appreciative audience here at the Proms, a unique audience for modern music. Tomorrow night is good fun.
And in the 7 o'clock start, Arvo Pärt's first symphony for 35 years, his fourth, gets its UK premiere from the Philharmonia and Esa-Pekka Salonen. In this week of Scriabin, there's more, The Poem of Ecstasy and Ravel's Left-Hand Piano Concerto. But for now, time to leave the Royal Albert Hall and for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 on Friday afternoon of next week. That's the 27th of August at 2:20. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer Prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to Proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
All right, now on Radio 3, after the premiere of composer James Dillon's piece La Navette in tonight's Prom, James talks to Andrew McGregor in the third of this year's Prom's Composer Portraits.
Welcome to this Prom's Composer Portrait, where we're about to meet James Dillon and hear some of his chamber music and piano pieces performed by musicians from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow, members of the Academy's Music Lab, its crack team of contemporary music enthusiasts, led by the Academy's conducting fellow Jessica Cottis. Now, James, the first work we're going to hear takes us back to the early 80s.
Zone de Azul, yeah.
De Azul. So there's a Spanish subtext in some
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, in 71 I met Robert Graves, the poet, at Idris Shah's house in Kent. And I hadn't seen him a long time, and I went to visit him. I heard he was sick in Deia. And it's one of the few occasions when I wrote a piece inspired by the landscape itself. It's not something that is common to my practice, shall we say. And so the origins of Zone was this Mallorcan summer I spent in Deia with Robert Graves.
And it seems to shimmer somehow. A lot of tremolos, a lot of glissandi, lots of swift time
the title
changes.
Itself,
it seems to give off heat almost.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. The title itself actually came from a poem by Jorge Luis Borges, and he's really talking about the Milky Way. And actually, my abiding memory in Deia was the skies, the night skies. And there was one night when actually there was an arc of blue. It was the Milky Way just crossing the Mediterranean. It was just something, kind of the image stuck with me. And so I kind of began to imagine what it might mean for a musical texture. But as I said, I mean, it's not... it's definitely not program music, of course, but it's definitely something that's unusual for me to respond so directly and try to kind of capture something.
Well, let's hear it for ourselves. To perform James Dillon's Zone de Azul, please welcome our musicians from the Royal Scottish Academy's Music Lab and conductor Jessica Cottis.
Thank you.
Zone de Azul, which I suppose we could translate as the Blue Zone?
Zone of Blue.
Zone of Blue, by James Dillon, performed by members of Music Lab from the Royal Scottish Academy in the city of James's birth, Glasgow. Clarinetist Fraser Langton, horn player David Smith, trumpeter Brian Allen, trombonist Davo Yule Magnusson, pianist Ed Cohen, violinist Willem Matlener, viola player Emma Peebles, and cellist Duncan Strachan, conducted by Jessica Cottis, who's actually Donald Runicle's assistant at the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. James, there's so many tiny changes of rhythm and pulse and time signature bar by bar. It really is massively complex for the players and the conductor to get their head around, and yet you generate this sense of fluidity, a sort of timeless flow. This sort of contrast between the detail and the overall effect seems to be something that's quite important to you.
Yeah, whenever I'm asked about who I studied with, I always say that the only teacher is nature in the end. And it seems to me that I'm kind of responding to a certain kind of complexity in the world, and it's very nuanced. I'm interested in the smallest musical transition, the musical nuance itself. It's the kind of like it's the difference between, let's say, the way that Glenn Gould will take a note, and the way that András Schiff will take a note, or the way that Muddy Waters will bend a note, and the way that John Williams will not bend a note. It's kind of the characteristics of playing itself fascinate me. The fact that the smallest transition can actually have the largest effect, the most expressive effect. So I've often tried to somehow, how does one weave that kind of microscopic information into a larger architecture is the battle. And of course, whilst there's a lot of disruptive elements in the music, I'm kind of almost aiming for something that feels natural.
And are you actually looking for specific patterns, things that you can use to generate your own patterns in the music, or is it more of an instinctive and reactive kind of?
Well, it's always a rich mixture between something that's highly measured and something that's much more instinctive and intuitive. And if the measurements don't make any sense to me, then I change them. And I might change them by hand, or I might recalculate things. But it's always, for me, it's a kind of interweaving of something that has a certain kind of precision and measure to it, and something that is much more chaotic and much more unpredictable, and something that's kind of, I'd let my nose lead me through it.
Now, you mentioned a couple of very different guitarists back there. You were a guitarist yourself, weren't you? Take us back to the 1960s when you were playing in a rock band down in Cornwall, and what was it that actually turned you on to classical music? What were the sounds you heard that first pulled you in that direction?
Well, first of all, it wasn't called a rock band at that time. Rock was a term that was in. They dropped the and roll part of it. I used to know something called rock and roll, but when I was involved in something what was called rhythm and blues music, it was kind of it's the kind of thing that Rolling Stones, the Pretty Things, the Yardbirds were doing. But I lost interest in it when I was 18. I could see somehow that it began to become incredibly decadent, self. Important, and it didn't interest me. And by accident, I didn't know which direction to go in. But I was also I was struggling with the musicians I was working with at the time. I was beginning to put ideas to them that they were misinterpreting. They thought I was moving in the direction of progressive rock, which was for me was like moving towards the devil. And so, I by accident discovered Webern and Stravinsky, and I began to investigate this kind of music, and it was completely new to me. I didn't know anything in the 20th century beyond Rachmaninoff. That was as far as the 20th century was concerned.
Can you remember the effect those sounds had on you? Because if you have no preparation for those musical worlds.
I was completely astonished by it. I didn't understand Webern. It was the Five Bagatelles, string quartet. And it just seemed like this is the craziest music I've ever heard in my life. And I wanted to know why, where it had come from, and why someone could strip something to its kind of the essence of gesture. And it began to fascinate me. I discovered very quickly Xenakis and Stockhausen, and they were really the important turning point for me, because then I could see it was music that was being written today, and it was about ideas, and I found very, very attractive.
And what about the complexity of people like, well, some Stockhausen, obviously, and Xenakis, mm-hmm. and particularly, was that something you automatically found attractive, the level of detail that...
The level of detail, for sure. The complexity is a sort of, you know, it's become such a loaded term, yeah. and one that I've, you know, spent 25 years trying to divorce myself from, in the sense that it's because it was I think, too associated with the look of the score more than anything else. I think all music is complex. I, like I said earlier, began to become interested in the small nuances, which took me into a territory of kind of microscopic territory, which meant that sometimes I was trying to organize things that previously would be seen as the player's business, because I was fascinated by the difference that it made. And I think that comes out of my fascination with the act of interpretation. The score, what differentiates the Western classical tradition is the score from all other classical traditions, the Indian tradition or the Japanese Gakkaku tradition, or this written tradition, the thing that Plato, of course, was objecting to. And so the score enables one to move into a territory which is unimaginable on a more spontaneous level. You can imagine how to organize things at a very, very small level.
Let's talk about the way you've organized things in the two piano pieces we're going to hear next, because they're both much more recent, written in the last couple of years. And I was curious about the titles, because Charm and Dragonfly, they both seem as though they have quite specific extra-musical inspiration, perhaps. And are they both for birthdays?
Yeah, they were very, very quickly written. I think Charm was written in a day and a half, and Dragonfly in less than a week, for sure.
And Charm, is this Charm as in Bewitch or Charm as in Bracelet? Or
yeah, I'm leaving it kind of open because, of course, Charm is also, is a fundamental particle in high-energy nuclear physics. And, you know, I spent part of the 70s subsidizing my own compositional studies by working at Imperial College across just down the road here. And it was just at the time of the beginning of the CERN project. So I became fascinated by that whole, you know, this quest for finding the essence of life, Charm was one of the names they gave to one of the fundamental particles at this time while I was there. They discovered the quark while I was there.
So talking about the essence of life, if we're talking about the birth of a child as well.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, for anybody who was working, and I was just working as a lab technician. You know, I wasn't a physicist, obviously. It was amongst the lab technicians, it was a big joke, the idea of looking for the essence of life. Still is a big joke.
What about Dragonfly? Is there anything literally depicting the insect here? Or?
Yeah, and it's something, for sure, it was actually based upon the observation of dragonflies. But I moved to Minneapolis 3 years ago, and in spring, these things come out of everywhere, and I was kind of curious about the nervioso quality of their flight, and so I was trying to capture a little of that, if you like. But it was written for a lady who got sick and was a close friend of mine, and she was a great gardener, and she would talk a lot about it. So it was a personal thing.
Well, let's hear them both. To perform James Dillon's piano pieces Charm and Dragonfly, please welcome back pianist Ed Cohen.
Thank you.
dragonfly capturing some of the iridescence and lightning-fast movements of the insects in music by James Dillon. And before it, we heard Charm, played for us by Ed Cohen from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama's Music Lab. And James, after hearing those pieces, with Dragonfly, it sounds as though you have something which gives you a level of control, parameters within which to write. But every time you start a musical journey, every time you begin a piece, the possibilities are limitless. How do you define the landscape or soundscape or the boundaries within which you're going to create a piece?
It varies from piece to piece. I mean, I have different strategies. One of the things that I try to do is not repeat myself. So that's a kind of already certain, it creates certain boundaries. By repeat, I'm talking about, my own recent past. One of the things that I never calculated for was that I would build up a body of work which actually then I become self-conscious about. It could come from a title, it could come from, but it's usually something small that I begin to build up a set of, I look for a way that I can spin outwards from the initial idea. In other words, what kind of connections can I make? Every piece for me is a kind of Indra's net in a way. Things are interconnected in different ways, and sometimes they can be loosely connected initially. I can take two ideas which are initially unrelated. Part of the ludic quality of working is actually finding ways to connect them. And that produces something else, which takes me in another direction. So sometimes some pieces are kind of very organic like that. Other times I have a very strict form scheme. For example, when I was working during most of the 80s on Nine Rivers, I was working to a very close form scheme. But that was where my head was at that time. I was very much interested in musical architecture.
But Nine Rivers is an interesting case in point, because that's absolutely off the scale in the other direction, isn't it? These are pieces which you've been writing, orchestral works and involving some electronics, which have taken you the best part of 20 years, finished in 1999, I think. There have been individual performances of the individual works, but you're heading towards a world premiere of the entire work later this year, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right, in November in Glasgow. So that's the first time it's put together as it was originally designed.
But you did actually have that original design right from the outset.
Yeah, it came about through an accident. I mean, I was commissioned to write work for Six Percussion, East 11th Street, and it was halfway through I realized, in fact, and I was deliberately not using pitched material. I used it just very, very briefly at the end of the piece. Now, it was a challenge for me. It was the first time I tried to construct a musical architecture without the use of pitch. And I began to imagine, actually, how I could take it one step further, how I could then some of the processes and calculations I was making in that piece actually had other implications for me. And it was that at that moment before when I was around halfway through the piece or something, I began to draw up this synopsis for a large cycle that the thing would kind of fan out from the most primitive of instruments, the percussion instruments, into something increasing. And of course, it gets more and more sophisticated towards the end of the cycle because I use more increasingly computer technology. So we
feel your development as a composer as a consequence of the span of the piece's composition.
I think for sure there's a trace of history there, of course, and it's a particular kind of direction that I was. I still maintain an interest. It's not too far away, of course, to Once Upon a Time, because I was still obsessed with Varèse at this time. Varèse was the composer that I kind of discovered through Xenakis, and the rawness. It always seemed to me, and it's something I talked about a lot in the 80s, that the dialectic of Adorno's dialectic between the Second Viennese School, the Schoenberg and the Stravinsky, he seemed to leave out the most important figure for me, which was Varèse, and the most flawed composer as well, of course, than the in many ways the rawest of the three figures.
But often it's the flaws that are fascinating, isn't it?
But of course, Adorno argues that Schoenberg liberates the tone And Stravinsky liberates rhythm, and of course Varese for me liberates noise. And noise is a component that that's in every sound. And it was something I wanted to explore more. And so I'm dealing a lot with the idea of what constitutes this strange territory between tone, noise, harmony, timbre. And this is kind of lies behind as a kind of backdrop to the Nine Rivers cycle.
Well, we're going to hear Once Upon a Time next. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's how all the best fairy tales begin, but I suspect the title and the word time is the critical thing here, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm punning, but it's also, it was a kind of opus one in a way, like I said earlier, and it's written for the octandra.
It's the same instrumentation, Varese.
And it was really the first piece I really let go and just said, okay, you know, it's finished. I want nothing else to do with this Boulezian idea of work in progress or keeping things in cupboards and not revealing them. So I decided from that point that I just thought, okay, you know, I really have to have the courage to let things go and give them to performers. And
time to go public. Well, and there is a set of instructions at the beginning of the score. I like the way you finish after all of them. You say the ensemble should aim to produce as continuous a structure as possible, despite everything you throw at them, because the conventional ideas of blend are not really things that are easy to bring to play with a score like this.
No, and I think, you know, there's a certain continuity in rupture. So I'm playing with the ruptured surface as a kind of another form of musical tension. But for that to work as a tension, it needs a degree of continuity, I think.
Well, let's see if they find it. And to perform James Dillon's Once Upon a Time, please welcome the octet from the Royal Scottish Academy's Music Lab, conducted once again by Jessica Cottis.
Thank you.
Once Upon a Time, music by James Dillon, first performed in 1980, and you've just heard it 30 years on, played by members of Music Lab, flautist Sarah Hayes, Arlene Cochran, Fraser Langton, Anna-Mary Lynch, David Smith, Brian Allen, Davor Yule Magnusson, and Chris Sargent from the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow. Thanks to all of them, to pianist Ed Cohen, and to the Scottish Academy's conducting fellow Jessica Cottis for joining us for this Proms Composer Portrait. The last of this season's series is on the 8th of September. Tansy Davis talking about her chamber music and her Proms Commission Wildcard. So until then, thanks to the Royal College of Music here in London for having us. And most of all, for talking to us about why his music sounds the way it does, James Dillon.
And that Proms composer portrait was presented by Andrew McGregor. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 16 minutes past 11. Time now for us to join Fiona Torkington with tonight's edition of Late Junction. Aš norėčiau numirti, bet mano šonai nepraleidžia kūkų. Aš paskutinis mamutas, taip buvau, kai jo buvau. Ir vienas dievas, te žino, kai aš pavargau. Aš pavargau, aš pavargau, aš pavargau. Paskutinės mamutas šioj įšalo žemėj mano iltis per trumpos, o akis per senos.
Lithuanian singer Alina Orlova opening Late Junction tonight with the Song of the Last Mammoth. Coming up later on tonight, music by Gia Cancelli, who's 75 this month. How Gelb teams up with a gospel choir, and there's more from the new album by Andy Cutting as well. A song originally from northeast Scotland next tonight, performed by the very talented Owl Service. On vocals, Dom Cooper, Jason Steele and Stephen Collins.
I was a young man, I was a rover. Nothing could satisfy me but a wife. When I reached the age of 20, weary was I of the single life.
Very first year, my wife I married. Out of a company I could not stay. Her voice was sweet as a lark or a linnet, the nightingale at the break of day. Now she's fairly altered her meaning. Now she's fairly changed the tune. Nothing but scolding comes from a mouth.
To me, cheer up my sins. Husband dear, put down your feet.
The baby cried, she bitterly scolded. Down to the door, I was forced for to run. Without trousers, hat or waistcoat, the poor man's work is never done. I'll go up to the top of the hill to view my sheep that had all gone astray. When I came back, she was lying in a bed at 12 o'clock on a winter's day. Side.
The Owl Service and I Was a Young Man, which comes from their CD The View from a Hill. They and their Riff Mountain label stablemates will be at the Ghosts from the Basement Day at Cecil Sharp House in London on the 25th of September. Radek Tulish from Tuva next tonight with a style of throat singing he learned from his uncle. Orphans are considered to be very unlucky in family-loving Tuva, and this is a number called Orphan Child. Thank you. That's multi-instrumentalist Espen Sommer Eder, also known as Fonu Fani. He's also a member of the duo Alog, and traditional Norwegian folk instruments have influenced his new album, where he's joined by the singer Agnetha Christensen and harmonium player Sibjørn Apeland. That was a track called Neverdal, and that followed Tuven Radik Tulish. A song by the 12th century French troubadour Berenguer de Palau now. It's performed by the group Convivencia.
Sulla mirarla che vos buscate non vos e già se n'altra paesaggio.